The countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds that you won't see anywhere else. But don't wait, because the most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now's the perfect time to cross names off your list. From practical gifts like a cast iron potato baker to unique and interesting gifts for kids like a smartphone-controlled paper airplane, Uncommon Goods has something for everyone that you're not going to find anywhere else. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've given away over $3.1 million so far. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/JFK. That's uncommongoods/JFK for 15% off. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body really is? It's true, your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. That's why learning your biological age can be truly life-changing, and that's exactly what the True Age test from True Diagnostic helps you do. With just a simple at-home test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights to help you take control of your health like never before. No doctor visits, no labs, just a quick finger prick from the comfort of your own home. True Diagnostic doesn't just tell you your biological age, it gives you a personalized report that's full of clear, science-backed steps that you can take to actually slow down aging and improve your health over time. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com. You can use the code JFK to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code JFK at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Today, on a special bonus episode of Solving JFK, we're taking a closer look at one of the most intriguing figures connected to the Kennedy assassination story, journalist Dorothy Kilgallen. Kilgallen was one of the earliest television personalities, starring on the show What's My Line. She was also one of the country's most prominent investigative journalists, and she was syndicated in over 200 newspapers and nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She was also a fixture in major trials of her era, including the Jack Ruby trial in Dallas. Kilgallen had a personal relationship with John F. Kennedy, no, not the kind you're thinking, and she became very interested in understanding what really happened to him. Kilgallen questioned the official story early and publicly. She privately told friends that she was receiving threats, and she believed that she was close to breaking open the case. Then, in November of 1965, she died under circumstances that remain disputed, and her JFK assassination research notes disappeared. To help us understand Dorothy's life and the unresolved questions surrounding her death, we're joined today by Sarah Jordan Heintz, an award-winning journalist and author of the book The Incredible Life and Mysterious Death of Dorothy Kilgallen. Sarah's earlier 2007 article was the first to publicly identify the man who became the prime suspect in Kilgallen's death. Her book brings forward new eyewitnesses, forensic clues and what she describes as the smoking gun linking a Kilgallen murder suspect to CIA operations. We're also joined by Larry Jordan, a journalist and JFK researcher for 50 years. Larry is the only writer to have developed a long-term, candid rapport with Ron Pataki, the man many suspect may have been involved in Kilgallen's death. Through years of conversations, unlike the brief or hostile encounters other researchers had with Pataki, Pataki shared with Larry details about CIA-linked training and covert operations that shed new light on Pataki's background. This is the first time Larry Jordan, who happens to be Sarah's dad, by the way, has stepped forward publicly to discuss that work. We'll explore Dorothy Kilgallen's reporting, the risks that she faced, and the suspects in her death with Sarah and Larry coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed questioning the man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
Welcome to Solving JFK, Sarah and Larry.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. And I, you know, one thing I like to ask people when they first come on, because for me, the answer is the Billy Joel music video for We Didn't Start the Fire, where Jack Ruby is shooting Oswald. And I, as a kid, I'm going, what's this? And so I ask everyone, what was your sort of entree into the JFK assassination? I guess, Larry, we'll start with you and then Sarah.
Well, thank you for having us. I appreciate that. I'm a baby boomer, so I grew up with JFK. I actually saw him in 1959 when I was 7 years old, when he came to my hometown of Cedar Rapids. I remember him driving through the city and waving at us in his convertible motorcade. And of course, I remembered the 13 days in October of 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis and how it affected our family life and the lives of so many people who literally thought the world could come to an end in 24 hours. Even at school, we had drills, you know, the duck and cover drills. And I vividly remember his assassination. I was in sixth grade when that happened. So I grew up having an interest in him. And over the years, it just grew and grew as more revelations came out. You know, the fact that the Zapruder film finally made it to TV was a big turning point. And ultimately, when I became a magazine publisher, I decided it was worthy of doing a story on the Midwest connections to the assassination. And that appeared in the first issue of Midwest Today back in 1992.
All right. What about you, Sarah?
Well, I certainly grew up interested in the Kennedy assassination, largely through my father's interest. So that's where it began. And then when I decided to write the article on Dorothy and later write the book, there were so many connections to Kennedy that I wanted to include that in Dorothy's story. It was such a big part of what she was investigating in the time of her death and what I think got her killed in the first place. So that just really amped up my interest when I got interested in Dorothy Kilgallen.
You guys have done some important work on Dorothy Kilgallen, so let's get into it. Before we get into the circumstances of Dorothy's death, let's talk a little bit about who she was as a person. I mean, I kind of listed some of the highlights, but she was a cultural figure, a celebrity. I mean, is that, you know, Sarah, for people who only knew her from television, I mean, what would you say Dorothy Kilgallen was? I mean, how would you compare her to you know, people today? I mean, because she was really a real big celebrity in a time when there weren't as many celebrities.
Absolutely. So Dorothy was first and foremost a journalist, a reporter with the Hearst Syndicate, covering murder trials, hard news, was not a sob sister. Hearst gave her the opportunity to write the hard news right alongside male colleagues. And she was as famous as the people that she wrote about in her Voice of Broadway column. In fact, she would often use the Voice of Broadway, which was aimed at entertainment news, to share her musings and opinions and views on geopolitical issues, particularly her criticisms of Fidel Castro, just really what was happening on the global scene. So she was very well connected with sources and contacts, you know, a real, what I would call a journalist journalist, and very in the old school way.
And she would, I mean, she covered trials. That was one of the things that she did, right? Like Sam Shepard. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very prominent case. You know, it was certainly a media circus when the prominent doctor was accused of murdering his pregnant wife. It was very circumstantial. And Dorothy did not feel that the state had proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed the crime, Sam Shepard. And it wasn't so much she maybe believed in his personal innocence as feeling that there was not due process. And I think this is a theme we're going to see with her reporting on the Kennedy assassination, Jack Ruby, about due process, having all the facts. And her view was so important that when Sam Shepard was convicted, the Journal American ran a big banner headline that said, "Dorothy Kilgallen shocked." And of course, we would learn later on that she would be instrumental in him receiving a new trial, where new evidence, F. Lee Bailey was that attorney, and ultimately being acquitted. And this was after Dorothy's death, that the DNA forensics just weren't there. But she was that early champion of knowing there was more to that story and that it would take a turn.
So Kilgallen was, you know, somebody who, even before the JFK assassination, you know, was willing to go against the grain and kind of challenge.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Official stories, criticized public figures, sitting presidents. It did not matter if you were on the radar as needing to be taken to task, criticized, exposed. She was willing to do it. Absolutely.
I was just going to interject that Marlon Swing, who was a producer at CBS, a very close personal friend of Dorothy's, called our office after Sarah's Midwest Today article came out, and I tape recorded that conversation. I have a bad habit of doing that. I have a recorder on my desk, and so when somebody important like that calls, I'm able to record it. But he had a quote that I liked. He said, "Dorothy was a very powerful woman. People don't have any idea of the power and contacts she had." She knew people in the government. She knew people that were mobsters. Mm-hmm. She had sources worldwide.
So to that end, and talking about her knowing people, she knew President Kennedy. I mean, they weren't extremely close, but she did have some interactions with him, right?
Yes, it was the January before the assassination. Dorothy and her youngest child, her son Kerry, visited the White House. They were under the impression it would be a guided tour, but not guided by JFK, who happened to have some time in his schedule to make an appearance. And he was so gracious and accommodating of Kerry's questions, gave them a few souvenirs on the way out the door. And I can say myself as a mother, how I would certainly connect with, wow, you took the time to make my child feel special, you know? And I think there was a real affinity there. Now, certainly going through Dorothy's earlier columns, years before the assassination, she wrote very glowingly of Kennedy, that, you know, he was always being criticized, stuff thrown at him, and just how wonderful he was, what outstanding woman Jackie was. And I think too, you have to see the context of the era. Dorothy came from an Irish Catholic family. And I think, with Irish Catholic roots myself, I know that he was so revered in homes in the 50s and 60s of Irish Catholic families. One of us has made it, right? And I think there had to have been some of that touching her as well, that maybe came out in the form of her pen.
Turning to the assassination, Dorothy Kilgallen was one of the first major journalists to question the official narrative, right?
Absolutely. Now, before that, she wrote two columns through the Hearst Syndicate that talked about her visit to the White House. She wanted to remind people about this is the man that was assassinated, killed, shot down in the prime of his life, a very warm and lovely man. The second column dealt with Jackie. She called it Jacqueline, a profile in courage and more, and was just very complimentary of this young woman, now a widow, making it on her own. And she got a lot of wonderful fan mail about, even people who didn't read her column regularly were very touched by her reporting. And then after Ruby shot Oswald on live television, the tone of those columns changed dramatically. So most notably, we have The Oswald File Must Not Close. And that was published November 29th of 1963. And it begins with LBJ in the first sentence. He's been elevated so swiftly to his new post that it's like he is in an ivory tower. And she's very concerned about, Oswald being, quote, the most important suspect or prisoner the country's had in custody in the last 100 years. And questioning, how is this case closed, right? She felt like if this was going to be poorly handled, this official story, it would potentially cost Johnson the 1964 election. And, she's saying this is not closed. This case is not closed. And she wrote, "Well, Tex, write a footnote for me, will you?" She wanted to know how Ruby even got access to Oswald, calling him a striptease honky-tonk owner, waltzing in like the police department was a health club. So already she's questioning the security that this was allowed to happen. Oswald will not have a day in court. I think she was very struck by the concern of that, and famously wrote, "When you pull, justice is a big rug. When you pull it out from under one man, a lot of others fall too." And my favorite part of this column is when she wrote, "The American people have just lost a beloved president. And it's a dark chapter in our history, but we have the right to read every word of it. It cannot be kept locked in a file in Dallas." So already, I think there's a bit of some prescience on Oswald is going to remain a little cloudy and murky, his background, and she was already seeing what was going to happen, I think.
Was there anything in particular that she was focused on in terms of like pieces of evidence, or was it just the macro of it all of like, hey, wait a minute, the guy that everyone's saying shot the president, who we really don't know about, somebody shot him, this doesn't sound right? Was it kind of like, my question is, was she more cautious? Like, hey, let's slow down before we all, jump on the Oswald did it train. Or was she more, hang on, this smells funny?
I think this smells funny.
Okay.
And I think you also have to see in her columns that she's talking about questioning the veracity of Howard Brennan, being able to have identified Ruby as a shooter, saying the TSBD was not immediately secured, the weapon changing from a Mauser to the Carcano, the changes with, she got the police kind of car-to-car radio transcripts where Jesse Curry was riding, chief of police of Dallas was riding in the pilot car and described shots coming from the front. And then the next day that story is changing. So she's kind of hitting one thing after another of this doesn't make sense, security is lax, was just very relentless in putting that all out. And I know you wanted to.
Well, I was going to point out one column as a background in newspapers that I have that struck me was her very bold reference to the 7 days in May, which was a current film. And she said the producers of 7 days in May could be forgiven if they thought that life imitated art. And she pointed out that the theme of this movie, the script of this movie, pertained to a coup that originated in Texas. Now, what was she trying to imply other than the involvement of LBJ?
Yes.
I'll just be blunt about it. This woman had bigger balls than any of those fellow journalists. And there were guys like Bob Considine who were reproaching reporters over in Europe who were raising questions about the, the lone assassin and downplaying that, scoffing that, saying it was ridiculous. And that was the norm. Dorothy was the standout reporter who was brazenly going after this. She didn't rely on Mark Lane. She didn't need coaching. She had a background in this from having covered murder cases, not just the Sam Shepard or Jack Ruby. She had a long history. So this just didn't have, it didn't smell right to her what had happened in the Kennedy
Absolutely.
Case.
And that column was published December 23rd of 63, which is important to note. It was the day after Harry Truman's big op-ed that ran in papers across the country. And I talk about that in my book, if you'll indulge me a moment on that one. And for people who aren't familiar, a month to the day after the assassination, so December 22nd, 1963, former President Harry Truman decides that he wants to go public with his thoughts. You know, this is days before Christmas, the nation's in mourning, a man from his same political party's in office. This could have been a real, what I call sort of an Obama bringing the country together moment, a real moment of hope and optimism. But instead, he uses that platform to decry the abuses of the Central Intelligence Organization, and it's become a cloak and daggerish operation. And that is what he wanted to leave the American people with. He maybe had the opportunity to talk to people privately. I would think you'd have some of the same security clearances as a former president, if there's anyone he wanted to take aside and express concerns to. And he may have done so, but he also wanted the public to know about these concerns. He wanted to make them front and center. And that was very deliberate, I think.
And he had formed the CIA, basically.
Right, 1940.
And he felt it had varied from its mission, mm-hmm. or strayed from its mission.
Yeah.
And one thing that Sarah points out in her book is the feds, I'm not sure exactly what entity, visited the Truman library and assets in Missouri and confiscated things, retrieved things. People don't know that. In retaliation for him speaking out.
I know that Alan Dulles visited him and asked him to retract it. Isn't that right?
That's, I don't think that I've heard that, but yeah.
I had not heard that, but it would not surprise me. And I love talking about Alan Dulles. Anytime you want to segue to him, he's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
I will fact check that and pull it out if it's not true. Is it true that there's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to the Warren Commission where Hoover says that he heard Kilgallen say that she would rather die than give up a source? I came across this document.
We know it's true that she was visited, and I think it was an attempt at intimidation, right?
It was a report from the two agents that went out to her home, and she actually wrote a column about that and said that they would have been more profitably spending their time if they had ignored the questions of her about where her source came from and pursued the other lines of inquiry that they had failed to pursue. So she did feel a little bit intimidated. It was obviously an intimidation attempt. Of course, that did not come, you know, immediately. She was doing all these other columns leading up.
Yes, we've jumped ahead just a scotch. This would pertain to the Ruby transcripts, right? So Dorothy, in a three-part series, published the excerpts of the 102-page transcripts of Ruby's testimony to Gerald Ford and Chief Justice Earl Warren. And so the excerpts began appearing in syndication August 18th of 64. So that, I believe, is what brought the FBI to her door, that column specifically, because LBJ had not even been presented with this yet. This was about a month. You know, I know it was September of 64 where LBJ was formally presented with the Warren Commission volume. So she had jumped the gun on this about a month. And I think that was a very deliberate move, maybe even a bit of a power play on her part.
The transcript not only ran on the front pages of a three-part series of newspapers nationwide, but it ran next to her own commentary and analysis. So she was considered to be,
absolutely
well enough versed on this topic that she was, that kind of status was conferred on her. Like, this is an expert that knows. Another testimony to just how, you know, her acumen as a reporter.
So let's talk about her covering the Jack Ruby trial. That was just, I guess, something that flowed from her coverage of the case already. The Ruby trial was the next thing, but she actually went down to Dallas and she was there for the trial.
Yes. As were many newspaper reporters, right? It was the biggest place to be, the biggest news story at the time. And I think she knew she would be able to perhaps penetrate that line a little bit of getting access to Ruby and his counsel, his defense team easier than people from other papers would, because she's not just a reporter, she's a television radio personality and a household name.
Well, Joe Tannehill, who was one of Ruby's attorneys, said that Jack was a fan. And when she entered the courtroom, she was like the celebrity. The judge asked for her autograph, to give you some idea. So there was a whole bunch of world press there in a very hot, compact kind of, everybody squeezed into the courtroom. And this is the star that enters the room, and all eyes are fixated on Dorothy. So there's no difficulty on her part in securing interviews with Jack Ruby because she was the star attraction. And as a matter of fact, it was even said that Jack would have the show on in the club and he'd yell at patrons to quiet down because he was watching What's My Line.
Oh,
So
wow.
Jack Tannehill is quoted in a video interview as saying that Dorothy was to Jack a VIP. So he felt flattered that she showed interest.
Sure. Yeah, and isn't it true that Dorothy would go to dinner with Tannehill and Melvin Belly, the lawyers for Ruby? Like she was pretty close, fairly close enough with them that she would go to dinner a couple of times with them and get inside information.
I remember, just because I love oysters, this is an odd memory, but the lead attorney had a real fixation on this one particular restaurant, and it had the greatest oysters. So he wanted to take Dorothy there to sample these oysters. So they were in on their photograph together, the three of them, Melvin Belli and Dorothy and Joe Tannehill. So she really had the priority, and there was a little resentment there. Plus, she was a mere woman. Let's not forget the times. Most women in journalism were assigned to cover home features. I know this from my own journalistic background, or recipes and that kind of thing. They were not given hard news assignments, usually.
But William Randolph Hearst, for all of his faults,
Right.
was her biggest champion.
Yes.
And of course, after his passing in the 50s, that continued on, with the Hearst Syndicate of saying, yeah, send Dorothy to cover coronations and political events and big stories.
Sarah really brings to life the color of that trial, the Ruby trial, all the atmospherics. It's fun to read it, and there's some eccentric things. There was even, despite all the police presence, there was even an escape attempt.
Going
It's
on in the jail,
unbelievable. Somebody had fashioned a fake gun out of a bar of soap and
So,
painted. I mean, it was unbelievable. It's like Keystone Cops that was going on there. Even though it was a deadly serious trial that had, impacted the world.
right. So the two conversations that Kilgallen had with Ruby, let's zoom in to those if we can. Were they both in the courtroom and they were just sort of up at the counsel's table, like where the defendant was? Or where were the actual interviews when
I
she
believe
interviewed?
so. He was not in behind bars.
One was in the judge's chambers,
Judge's
as I
chambers,
understand, the bigger one.
yes.
And Joe Tannehill is the source, and we don't have to
Who
address it.
witnessed them
Right. He's
communicating?
in a video interview saying this, that Ruby took it seriously. They had a serious conversation. It wasn't just pleasantry.
I want to bring in some points from the other side. So Fred Litwin, who you may know, has an article where he breaks down the Dorothy Kilgallen story, and his primary counterpoints as to why, hey, she didn't have some secret information about Ruby. This is all overblown. Really, he's got two things. One is that, look, they didn't talk that long. It was a fleeting, very, very brief conversation, is the first point he makes. And the second point is, if Ruby told her something, why didn't she publish it sooner? Why wait so long? Why not come out with it right away? So what would your answers be to those
Yeah,
criticisms?
absolutely. So I am a working journalist. I'm a newspaper and magazine journalist, and I conduct interviews on almost a daily basis. And I certainly know that it does not take a large amount of time to get the information out that you would require. It could be just a couple of handful of questions. And it has nothing to do with the amount of time. It's the quality of the interview and how willing someone is to be forthcoming. This can be done in a matter of seconds, really. I don't think the exact time stamp is what matters so much. And I think Dorothy, being such a career journalist, knew that whatever he told her had to be with some kind of confidence until she was able to fact check, add sourcing, build a case, and prepare what was going to be in a book. And certainly things were going through her column those last 2 years of her life. She's very, very fascinated in the case, almost borderline obsessed. So it wasn't that she was sitting on information. Things were coming out in her column. But I think there was certainly an incentive to wait until perhaps the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted.
I'm glad you brought this gentleman up, because I note that he said that Dorothy could not possibly have obtained anything useful from Jack Ruby, because he was not part of any conspiracy, and he just acted on impulse in shooting Oswald. So when you have somebody that comes from that thesis, why argue with them? Their minds are closed. They're ignoring a massive amount of information about this case. And it really is kind of misogynistic, frankly. I noticed that the people criticizing Dorothy invariably are men.
It has often been the case, even since my book came out, you know, a little bit of, dare I say, mansplaining of, well, you wrote a book about Dorothy. I mean, she was just on television. She wasn't a serious reporter. And, you know, I'd be kind of inundated with that on social media. And I just felt like you don't have the facts.
There's another aspect of this that I think is also overlooked, and that is it wasn't necessarily the information that Dorothy had gleaned from Jack, but the fact that she was such a muckraker as a journalist that she might have been killed just because they knew she had this zeal to find the truth and she was not going to give up. She also had a receptive audience. I think maybe I'm wrong about this. She had a readership of something like 20 million readers. She could file a story as late as 4 a.m. and reach a mass American audience coast to coast that same day. That's in contrast to Mark Lane, who is an author. And I don't want to denigrate authors because we're both authors, but he didn't have that kind of outreach. So why did he survive and Dorothy didn't? Because she was a very potent threat.
Sure. Yeah. So that's an important point that you're making, which is that, you know, I think a lot of people want to say, oh, Dorothy, you know, if she was killed and it was somehow related to the JFK assassination in any way, it's probably something that Ruby told her, because, correct me if I'm wrong, and here's maybe the headline, Ruby didn't give interviews to anybody else, right?
Correct.
Okay. So that's what everybody says. But the point you just made is, yeah, maybe Ruby told her something that's salacious and would have got her killed. But even if he didn't, the mere fact of who she was, the position that she held, and her tenacity, the people knew that she wasn't going away and she couldn't be bought off. So that could have been it too.
She was like a pit bull. Once she got hold of something, she was not going to let go. And by the way, as far as why she was holding or sequestering information, she was writing a book. Here's a direct quote from Ron Pataki. He said, her book was a big deal right up to the time of her death. It was a book on the Warren Commission report. It wasn't on Jack Kennedy per se. It was on all the players. That's the thing. And as we get into this a little more, the things that he told me affirm that he was, you know, providing input, feedback. She was soliciting his opinion on things as her reporting and investigation evolved. So not only that, but Marlon Swing, the CBS executive, affirmed she was holding this for a book. So there are credible people close to her that knew that she was working on a book. That's the reason she wasn't blowing this all in a newspaper story. It would, you know, be
in
over
its
with
entirety.
It.
Yeah. I mean, she was still reporting.
Right, exactly. But the big stuff she was saving for that book. And she was nearing the end of her research. That's also affirmed by people close to her. So she became a very immediate threat at that point.
If we can, let's go to her actual death and the circumstances surrounding it. Can you just kind of tell us, you know, what happened, the details of it, you know, where was she last seen and how was she found?
Absolutely. So I'm starting to talk about the day of her death, but I think it's also important to kind of the lead up to her death, you know, the visits to Dallas, New Orleans, Miami, what her hairdresser, Mark Sinclair, had accompanied with her to part of it and then was sent home very quickly, right? Just saying, don't tell anyone you were with me. So I feel like that's worth diving into before the actual day of, because I think it's very clear there was a threat or a concern or something that she triggered kind of her senses of being on alert. After that point, she, I think, was pretty fearless, and then something had kind of spooked her. I know Pataki had used that term as well, that spooked her from the trip along, particularly to New Orleans.
You might point out that Mark Sinclair accompanied, well,
Yeah.
Mark Sinclair was asked to go to New Orleans, but via separate plane, separate hotel. He was to do her hair, but I think she wanted somebody along to just kind of be there, you know.
Check
And
in with.
then before he was to be with her the next day, but she called him abruptly at his hotel room and told him that there was an airline ticket waiting for him. She wanted him to immediately return to New York and never tell anybody he'd been there. So something did spook her after she got to New Orleans. The Journal American was on strike. And so she used that period, since they weren't publishing a newspaper then, to do things. She went to Miami, was talking about the case, by the way. Larry King used to have a radio show before he had a TV show. He was based in Miami, and she appeared on his radio show days before she died. So she was discussing that case. By the way, Larry King also thought she'd been murdered. But she had been to New Orleans and spooked on that occasion. She'd been back to Dallas after the trial. So I do know that she had some contact, or our suspicion is, with Jim Garrison.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, Ron Pataki bragged about the fact that he had met Jim Garrison twice. He's an entertainment reporter, Mr. Pataki. Why would he be so keenly interested in, you know,
Yes.
in
Doesn't make sense.
that? But anyway, so I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
So when she was, you said she was in New Orleans and she got spooked. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that was with Mark Sinclair.
Right.
Yeah, that was October.
And we're not sure exactly why it was, but it was very close to the time she died. So something happened
In the
there.
weeks before.
I beg your
You
pardon?
said.
What it was that spooked her.
Yeah, I think it was a meeting.
Well, she
So
said
it
that she'd never met the person she was going to meet, but she would know him by sight. Now, there is speculation that it was Jim Garrison. People say, no. You know, Garrison didn't pick up on the threat of this until later. But actually, that's not true. Garrison immediately, and you know this, I'm sure, within days, he was, you know, first of all, a district attorney there in New Orleans.
Yeah.
So he knew the crime figures and Carlos Mochello and all the others. And within, I think it was 3 days, he was already questioning people.
Before the
And
official investigation
before
was
the
launched.
official investigation. And if you were going to go to New Orleans as a reporter, who would you go to see? Wouldn't you think the local district attorney would be a good source? So our
Right.
speculation is that Garrison probably factored into that. She may have seen him, but she was also good friends with Frank Costello, who was a mentor of Marcello. And of course, Frank was based in New York. Dorothy, as Sarah lays out in her book, used to have, what was that name of that little club?
The Science
The
Club.
Science Club. It had
Thank
nothing to
you.
do with science,
Yeah.
but it was a little Monday get together for Blue Mondays. And she would assemble at the back of PJ Clark's in this one area at this one table. It could be Hollywood celebrities, it could be other people. But Frank Costello would
Absolutely.
attend those. So he knew Dorothy, and even gave her a beautiful, wasn't it a diamond?
It was a diamond necklace that she converted into earrings.
Yeah, maybe
Like
that's what
changed
got
the
her killed. You
setting.
know,
Yeah.
she melted down that necklace, and you know,
Yeah,
got,
we were
he
kind
was
of like,
so
ooh,
ticked off that that's
no
all
respect.
the case.
That took some
Yeah,
chutzpah.
I don't know. I think we're onto a new lead here, but also Marlon Swing, when I spoke with him, when he called the office after Sarah's article came out, we had about an hour, a little over an hour conversation, also on tape. And he talked about being out one night with Dorothy, and here comes Frank Costello. Of course, he knew who he was. And he was so surprised that he stopped at Dorothy's table. It was so pleasant. And Dorothy thought nothing of it. You know, this big mobster, this mafia kingpin.
Yeah, and she was
So
friends
she
with Phyllis
had,
McGuire.
so it,
Yeah.
and Phyllis McGuire,
Yeah.
who also said she was definitely convinced that, well, she just stated emphatically that Dorothy was murdered, period. And Dorothy McGuire was close to Sam Giancana and all that.
Sure.
She may have had help. She may have solicited help from Frank Costello, like who should I see or whatever. But the thing I think that Sarah stresses that's so valuable is that in studying Dorothy's columns, which no other writer has done, by the way, she really perused hundreds of columns. And it's amazing how many times in this little seemingly innocuous, gossipy, Voice of Broadway column, that Dorothy was interjecting a paragraph or two. There were vignettes in this column about what was going on with Castro or Latin America. And Florence Pritchard, who was married to a former ambassador of Cuba and
Earl
was
T. Smith.
also, let's see again,
Earl T. Smith, well, he
excuse
was
me.
ambassador to Cuba.
And Florence was also on the same newspaper, the Journal American. They were very good friends and so forth. Sarah documents all that. That was a good source for Dorothy to know inside information that was of a high secretive nature in terms
Yeah,
of U.S.
absolutely.
intelligence. And it was appearing in her columns. So this
Yeah.
is a woman that was formidable. This is not some little
Yeah.
waif that was concentrating on recipes or whatever, you know.
Sure. Yeah. No doubt. All right. So, in terms of her death,
Yeah.
can we talk about that that evening?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dorothy died November 8th of 1965, and she appeared live on What's My Line just the night before, the night of November 7th. She was on the panel. What's My Line was a game show. The panelists would guess the occupation of the contestant. Usually it was considered a bit unusual or didn't, the profession didn't match the face, right? And there'd be a mystery celebrity at the end of the show, and the panelists would be blindfolded for that. So she was on that last episode. That's the last time people would have seen her alive, at least publicly. But we know from her hairdresser, Mark Sinclair, that the lead up to that evening, he was doing her hair, talking about what she'd wear. And she wondered what his plans were. I believe he was going to a movie and declined going out with her after the show. It wasn't unusual for people to hang out at PJ Clark's, the Regency, after the show aired. And she was a bit reserved, a bit downcast, and he
They had
brings
a
up the fact
conversation on Saturday.
they did too on Saturday and Saturday before her death, and then the night
Yeah,
of,
she was very
talking.
upset. She thought that there was a leak somewhere.
Yeah, a
And
leak, she called it.
Sinclair
Yeah.
said, "Well, the only person new in your life is Bo." He called him Bo
Beau
Pataki.
Pataki.
And
Yeah.
so he kind of fueled her paranoia about him. That was on Saturday
And
before the
then,
Sunday.
yeah, so that is what we're referring to. Yeah. And if it's of interest, the outfit she was planning to wear with the hairstyle was changed last minute. So when Mark Sinclair watched the show, she was wearing a different outfit than he had paired the flowers and the hairdo to, noticing, oh, I wouldn't have done it that way. I'd known you were wearing that dress,
And there
right?
was nobody at that residence to help her get into that complicated outfit or get
Yeah.
out in and out of it because it was the maid and butler's night off. So that, added intrigue. He was so surprised to see her in a different outfit that didn't match her hair.
And he referred to it as more of what she would wear for kind of a date night, right? So that's where he felt that after he talked with Dorothy and said, I think Pataki needs a closer look, that she called Pataki, and he was in Columbus, Ohio at that time, hopped a plane. And then because the show aired at 10 p.m. Eastern time, he could be a kind of a late date by about midnight, 1 in the morning. And that is the unidentified man seen in the Regency Hotel bar that was never investigated by the police.
Okay, so just to zoom out just a little bit, the hairdresser sees her in different clothes. You're talking about the night she on November 7th when she went on the show, or you're talking about when he discovered her?
Yeah, we'll get to the discovery.
Okay, but
I'm
when she
talking
went on the
about
show that night,
she's on the show.
yeah.
Like there was a change of plans. She wasn't going to go home right after the showing or the filming, that this was what she was going to wear to do kind of the cocktails afterward, meeting up with someone. And we know from cast and contestants who were at the Regency that evening that she was seen with a man, kind of sequestered in the back, talking very closely, having a very serious conversation, that they did not feel like they wanted to intrude upon. So that man has never formally been identified.
Marlon Swing typically would go out after the show with her. He would sit up in the control room, he told me, while the show was being broadcast, and telepathically try to tell her who the mystery guest was, the big celebrity guest, because they would hide the celebrity guest in the control room. And he would know who that was. And sometimes it worked. That was their little inside game. But that particular night, he did not go out with her. But she met another friend, Bob Bach, who was part of the production team of What's
On the Show. Yeah.
And they went first to PJ Clark's. But it was a very quick drink. And she said she had a late date. Well, who would
with
that
who?
Be? Who she, was she dating at that time? Just both attacking. So another fortification of that.
If you listen to Solving JFK a lot, you know that I like to keep the vibes up. And that's why I'm a fan of federally legal cannabis from Mood.com. It's a brand that uses small organic farms to source its pesticide-free legal weed. You can get 20% off of your first order at Mood.com by using code JFK. My favorite product of theirs is the functional THC gummies. Usually I go with Epic Euphoria, but I also like Magic Mind and the Pure Relief CBD gummies. These legal weed gummies take about 20 minutes to kick in, and you can control the dosage yourself. Unlike the federal government, Mood.com has never sold drugs to fund illegal wars or clandestine missions. Thanks, Mood.com. So try out some of the excellent legal cannabis products from Mood.com and get a 20% discount off of your first order using code JFK. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick five-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service.
So, Pataki, you said he came in from Columbus, Ohio, that which is where I live. And I'm like, hey, tell me, what's the connection? So, was he from Columbus? Was he just working there or what?
Yeah, can we segue into Pataki?
Let's. Helpful? Can we just go to how her body was discovered?
Oh, absolutely. And then
Pataki,
So Mark Sinclair comes the next morning to do her hair. She had appearances to make and wanted to be ready for them. And he arrives at her five-story townhouse in Manhattan, has the key to get up the back stairs. And he goes to the room that would have the attached dressing room. So it was not her, it had a bed, but it was not her bedroom, but it was where he knew she would be to do the wardrobe, right? So he found her in that bed, her pajamas on over her clothes, the false eyelashes, the hairpiece, all the makeup still on, which any woman knows you don't want to sleep with that on. It's very uncomfortable. And what I would call a very staged crime scene.
Pajamas on over her clothes. Is that what you said?
Just that peignoir, right over the dress. So either whoever killed her staged the crime scene, or she was found somewhere else and they made it look nicer for when the police
were. Well, there was a book laying on the bed.
The honey
she
badger.
Already read.
Yep, already had
her glasses were nowhere around.
And the air conditioning turned up quite high in November in New York City.
And even Ron Pataki commented on that. You know, trying to make himself even less guilty looking.
Yeah.
And said, yeah, she was always cold. That didn't make any sense. But you might do that to change the time of death.
Throw off some suspicion on.
But
the honey badger.
Yeah.
What a book for her. Is that like a way to send a message of like she's trying to be a honey badger, but this is what it gets her?
I don't know, but she
I'm
had
not
already
sure.
The hairdressers knew that she had already completed reading
Yeah, she
because she
mentioned
had
it.
mentioned it.
Yeah.
And it was turned upside down in not a position that would, be logical on the bed.
Very staged, no other way to put
And
it.
her glasses were nowhere around, and she needed the glasses to be able to read. So it was very staged. She was propped up in bed. And he knew right away, Mark Sinclair said, when he walked in there, he first entered through the back and turned on his curling irons and so forth and walked in the next room because it was so cold. He was going to turn off the air conditioner. And lo and behold, she's there. He didn't expect to see her because her bedroom was on the fifth floor. And I think this was on what? Would you say the third?
That
I think
sounds
the
right.
third floor.
Yeah, where
And
he,
so it wasn't even, what is she doing in this bedroom?
yeah,
She
never slept in
never
that.
slept in that bed.
No,
So he was shocked.
that she would have ended up there.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about Pataki and why he's a person of interest potentially.
Absolutely. And I think too, to circle back on that, of course, Dorothy died of a drug and alcohol overdose. Circumstances undetermined. Authorities never decided to take the time to determine them. So it's a very odd thing to put on I believe on a death certificate. You know, it wasn't accident, wasn't suicide, wasn't homicide. Undetermined circumstances. And we know later on in the 70s when Lee Israel was exploring the story with her book, Kilgallen, that there were three different barbiturates found in her system. And that wouldn't have been known at the time in 1965. Forensics had just come a ways. So that is again where that suspicion came in, that we knew about the one sleeping pill, not three different,
Right.
the ones that are hard to pronounce, anabinol and
Is
sabinol.
that another way of saying the barbiturates that were in her system? A, there's a, is a combination. There were several of them, and B,
Three.
they're not necessarily the ones that she had access to, or
Yeah,
some of them.
absolutely. Yeah.
One of them did, and this is really jumping ahead a little bit, but when you want to think about anything incriminating about Ron Pataki, he wrote a couple of poems, one of which was about poisoning somebody with a drink,
He's quite
spiking
a
their drink.
poet. Yeah.
So, subconscious came out, I guess, on that one.
Yeah,
Okay.
absolutely. And so, as I briefly brought up Lee Israel a moment ago, in her book that came out in 1979, just called Kilgallen, she referred to Ron Pataki as the out of towner. But that's who he was. And when we began work on the article in 2006, I was 16 years old. I was a sophomore in high school. So my father, being a veteran journalist, said, I'm gonna jump in on this a little bit, right? And I think there was a bit of naivete on my part, being kind of small town Iowa teenager, like there wouldn't be any dangers or harms or threat here. Let's just dive right in, right? So we were able to obtain Ron Pataki's unlisted phone number, having been given a tip on he's the out of towner. So that's who was interviewed, quoted, who's referred to in Lee Israel's book. And my article was the first to actually name him as Ron Pataki. So
Well,
you called him.
yeah, I didn't feel comfortable having my 17-year-old or
At the
16-year-old
time,
daughter
yeah.
in contact with a
Go
guy
figure.
that might have, murderous tendencies. So I did the interview. We can talk about that in a little bit, but there were other things that Sarah was able to get a hold of, such as Lee Israel had never gotten any interviews with the hairdressers, who were very close personal friends of Dorothy's, by the way,
Mark
very
Sinclair
credible people.
and Charles Simpson.
And so she was able to quote extensively from that. New forensic evidence. I was able to actually get in contact with John Broich, who'd been part of the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. So it was updated on that. So Sarah's book, or I should say her article in 2007, was really the Rosetta Stone of this case. And at that point, Dorothy was really a dead and forgotten person. And look at how things have
Sadly,
mushroomed since that
yeah.
article. It spawned these books by people who have tried to turn Dorothy into a cottage industry with multiple books that even get more outrageous by the, the day. And but anyway, so Sarah was the one that premiered all these different things. And then ultimately, when we saw these other books coming out that were full of mistakes and conjecture and things, she decided she would write her own book. I'm not
Yeah,
sure we've
during about the
followed
time
that.
of the COVID pandemic. Yeah, and it was just going to
And
be kind of a adding to the article, really, and then it turned into a book. But
420 pages or whatever.
to go back to Ron Pataki, so you just called him up,
Yeah, I called him
and
up,
there you go.
I have interviewed over my career. I've been a newspaper and magazine publisher. I became involved in journalism when I was 15. And so I've been at this for a very long time. And my approach is to not only research the subject that I'm going to be interviewing, but also not take a confrontational approach. And I think that distinguishes my style from, let's say, and this is no denigration of your profession, but a lawyer, in this case, an author, sure. was much more adversarial. So he was not going to elicit the kind of information or confidential, you know.
Well, how would you? You call someone, say, I know you killed her, I'm going to get you. And but please talk to me for my book.
And I didn't that. I basically said that we were going to do a profile on Dorothy Kilgallen. And he said, oh, well, I knew her. I said, well, that's why I'm calling.
And if I can just interject for 1 second, Dorothy was born in Chicago. That was the Midwest connection.
Right.
Her father, Jim Kilgallen, was a career journalist with the INS, International News Service, for about 70 years. So that was my hook, that she was born in Chicago when he worked at the paper there. And
yes, and she got going. You may tell how old she was when she really started her career, too.
Teens. You know, she did not go to college. She went to Erasmus High School, a lot of famous people. Barbara Streisand was one, I believe, who went to that high school. And just absolute nepotism getting that first job, right, in the newspaper business. But her roots were in Chicago, so that's how I pitched the idea of, I want to feature Dorothy. I want to know what happened to her. Let's probe this and start. And Ron Pataki was a huge part of that puzzle.
Real quick, before we get into Ron Pataki, I just want to just sort of for my listeners and for my benefit too. What we've talked about so far, laying out the circumstantial case against Pataki, and then we'll get into what you guys found additionally. So the only circumstantial case is he's the guy who she was dating at the time, right?
Well, of course, according to Ron, it was a platonic relationship, that this was just a friendship. And people in her inner circle said it was definitely a romantic sexual relationship. He was 29, she was 51.
But there were things that were leaking from her private life that only he knew.
Yeah.
See. And do we know for sure that he flew from Columbus to New York that night? Like, where do you get that from?
No. And I don't think you mentioned that in the book. In
no, it's certainly a hypothesis of how he could have. You know, he said that he was at his desk the next morning. So the morning of the 8th, really, you know.
He's told multiple
versions.
There's
been multiple versions. That's
multiple stories that each conflict about how he found out about Dorothy's death.
And
yet he was her best friend. So wouldn't you think he'd remember?
And to piggyback off that, if he was sitting at his desk the next morning at the paper and found out, he had to have been the first. It did not go over the wire until about 3 o'clock Eastern time of her death. And also being an entertainment reporter, much like a sports writer, you would be working more of an evening shift. Like, again, I'm a newspaper reporter. The guys in the sports department come in about 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and work into the wee hours. They're not at their desk at 8 the next morning. So that didn't really wash that he was even there.
Also, Sarah, I can't quote it myself, but in Sarah's book, she also has proof that he was in New York City like the next day, at least by the next day.
Covering.
Because I think he was covering something.
Revealing.
He was writing about it.
Yeah.
So he was definitely, yet he never attended her funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So it really adds to the suspicion he flew on Sunday and met her for the late date. And he had an easy way of doing that. I even had a pilot friend now deceased, who said, oh, yeah, I actually flew that route, you know, from Columbus. He could easily have been there if she called him, let's say, before the show, mm-hmm. earlier in the evening. And he said, well, I'm going to come there and I'm going to prove it. I'm going to reassure you.
Yeah.
That's what precipitated her change of her attire, because she was going to meet him later. Mm-hmm. By the time the show was over with, he soon
was
in New York.
In the evening, yeah.
The people who saw her at PJ Clark's with the mystery man, presumably they're all dead and cannot identify. I mean, it was 20, 30 years later, you know, 40 years. It would be too late to go try to find those people and say, hey, this mystery man was at this guy Pataki.
Well, there was
reaching the Regency bar by that point.
Right. And other members of the cast would routinely go to the Regency.
Mm-hmm.
And Catherine Stone was one of the mystery guests on that podcast.
Yeah.
And Dorothy had guessed her profession. She was, I think,
selling dynamite.
Selling dynamite. And Dorothy was so alert that last night that she guessed the profession. And Catherine wanted to say something to her. So Catherine was invited to go along with everybody in the limos, the Seagulls limos, to the after party at the Regency. And she kept a very close watch on Dorothy because she wanted to have an opportunity to go over there and congratulate her, privately. But she noticed she was over in this corner having a very serious conversation with this man. They were sitting
Yes.
very close
And
together.
I think that's a missed opportunity because, of
Yes.
course, there could have been a picture of Pataki circulated to the staff and then
Right.
after, but he was never officially considered
And the
a
bartender
contact. Yeah,
knew,
that would have been
all
a
these things.
I say that in my book, that would have
Right.
been a wonderful opportunity to rule him out.
Sarah has a very detailed timeline of what we know irrefutably Dorothy was doing, including calling the Western Union office to arrange routinely for a courier to come to her apartment and pick up her column, which she had already written. And she was still, sober enough, I think, at 2:30.
This, yeah,
Two
2:30.
thirty.
And of course, her husband would tell the police she came home about 10.
Yeah,
The death certificate's very flawed
Dick
with
Colmar had
that.
been a radio star. He was also a theatrical person,
Producer, yeah.
producer, and Broadway and all that stuff. So her husband was into the entertainment field, but they had a very peculiar relationship, went their separate ways a lot of the time. He had his outside interests, she had hers. One of hers was Johnny Ray, the singer, off and on for a while, and then Ron Pataki. But anyway, he told a conflicting story that she had come home and retired for the night. We know that's not true because there were witnesses seeing her in
At
the
the bar
Regency
and
bar.
Western Union.
So
So,
that was clear.
yeah,
okay,
that.
sorry to interrupt you. That
Yes.
helps me understand. So Pataki, what's the what'd you find out when you went down that road?
Well, the first interview, which was really the substantive one for the purposes of Sarah's article. He answered a lot of questions with conflicting statements. And it was very obvious if you paid attention, you didn't even have to really concentrate on parsing his language. He'd say one thing 1 minute, and 3 minutes later, he'd say the complete opposite. He was very cordial and a very good conversationalist. And after the story came out, he called and I took the call and he applauded Sarah's work. I was concerned that he
Surprisingly,
would, be upset.
yeah.
He said, "I think it was the most professional job anyone could have done. It was fair and balanced," to quote Fox News, "because it presented both sides. She presented the evidence or the conjecture of what he had done, and then she allowed him, she gave him voice to refute that in print." And I think that's what engendered respect on his part for both of us. And then, to my surprise, he started calling me out of the blue, and we'd shoot the bull about, or shoot the breeze about the newspaper industry or whatever. And so I had developed that kind of, affinity because we're both in the background of newspapers. The other thing I'd mention is that besides that, I'm also a music producer as of 1999. And to this day, I still produce music that involves overdubbing new music on iconic performances by big artists, using world-class musicians. And Ron was very interested in music. As a matter of fact, he was kind of a frustrated, composer. He did manage to get some of his work recorded by the likes of Johnny Mathis and Jerry Vale and John Gary. So when we would talk not only about common interests like newspapers, but also about music. And he pitched me songs. And he would sing little parts of the songs, and they're on the tapes, which, by the way, Sarah's going to be posting excerpts of some of these tapes we're referring to
Yeah.
on her website, which is.
DorothyKilgallen.net.
So
Okay,
that
great.
happened soon.
Yeah, it's just time to.
But anyway, I can get a little bit more involved in this because over the years, then when Ron would call, we would shoot the breeze about all kinds of subjects. And then I'd say, "By the way, what about such and such?" And I would bring it up in an informal sense, not a
Yeah.
cross-examination kind of thing. And by that point, he was disarmed enough, he would say things. In fact, what amazed me is I had actually mentioned him about the online rumor that he'd gone to School of Assassins in Panama. And just as an aside, that completely freaked out Lee Israel, who had heard that Sarah had put that in her original article, and Sarah had not. And I got this irate phone call from Lee Israel one day saying, "Why are you quoting me as having said that, Ron attended the school in Panama for assassins?" I said, "Reread the article. Sarah did not mention that." She slammed down the receiver, and a little while later, she called back and apologized that she was paranoid about any notion that she would imply that he attended that school. Now, with me, he first denied it. I'll read you exactly what he said, and then I'll tell you what he actually said later. He said, I tell you if there was any truth to it. Why not? Which, by the way, there was no foundation for that. I did go to Guatemala when in a small military thing. There was a communist uprising in Guatemala. I did go, but nothing to do with assassins, for God's sakes, or training. And then minutes later, moments later, he talked about all this training he had. And it turns out that the Guatemala trip, which was in 1954, was a paramilitary operation. He was not in the military,
yeah,
like he told me. It was a paramilitary operation launched by Alan Dulles of the CIA, as Sarah reports, and run by E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis. So that is the smoking gun that Sarah came forth with.
Wow, enrolled at Stanford University.
Yeah, and tell about that. That's really interesting.
Well, we have Pataki school transcripts that show he was kind of an average student, but called ambitious, spoke Spanish, and had an interest in foreign service. And he got into a little trouble at Stanford, expelled, nothing too major, some
fake IDs.
Fake ID, yeah. You know, kind of juvenile stuff. And that was the summer of the Guatemalan coup. So him backing out of school, you know, definitely coincides with when he would have gone to Guatemala.
Well, the New York Times had done a story in 1977 about the CIA's recruitment efforts on various campuses, including Stanford. And Stanford had to confess that they had no knowledge of what was really ongoing. They were unwittingly sponsoring seven different fields of study that Pataki was there to partake of, including one which was a survey of the ways in which criminals gave drugs to the unsuspecting.
Yeah, I know.
So I don't know, maybe I'm just being paranoid here, but I think that has some relevance. But anyway.
What was Pataki's official job? What was he, like a reporter?
Entertainment reporter,
yes,
at the Columbus Citizen Journal. So
ultimately, he was not at the time he was recruited with the CIA, he was not.
A student.
But it's useful for people to know, you know, when he told me this, I'll admit, it kind of went over my head. It was when Sarah started working on her book that I reviewed these tapes. And I thought, oh my gosh, he was just admitting he was involved with the CIA. Because when he talks about the Guatemala thing, that was paramilitary. And as I said, it was run by the CIA. And then we started putting two and two together. So he obviously had a connection. But there were other little clues. He had run he'd done a column in 1965. He was an entertainment reporter by that point. And he had panned a movie called John Goldfarb, Please Call Home. And he was upset, not about the fact that they had portrayed a football coach in an unflattering way, like other reviewers were upset by. He was defending the CIA. He felt the movie misportrayed the CIA. So I could go through and, you know, Sarah could list all these different little clues.
At 65.
Fondness in his heart for the CIA.
Yes.
Okay.
Anything else he said to you thought was very
well
telling?
I mean, yes. On another conversation, he brought up, well, first of all, note that he brought up the Guatemala thing in response to my question about the School of Assassins. I didn't even know anything about the Guatemala thing. I thought it was very interesting that he brought that up. But anyway, another occasion he said, in regard to the School of Assassins, I always denied, but I really was there. So that was, you know, when he got even a little more comfortable.
He told you, I always denied it, but I really was
there. I really was there, quote unquote. Yeah, absolutely. When I questioned him more about his Guatemala trip, by the way, and this is a direct quote, he said, well, I don't get into that story, but I will tell you enough. I was in the military then, and they sent a detachment of us down there because of this communist uprising. They sent many, not just me. And I said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, what am I going to do? Tell the commies to lay off, you bastards? And so, you know, officially the U.S. had no troops there. I don't know how many people know much about Guatemala at that time, but the United Fruit Company was an American-based company that had bananas and so forth. They had vast land holdings there. And the president, Democratic elected president Arbenz, wanted to reclaim some of that banned land, only 15% of which was in cultivation. And so he paid the United Fruit Company double what they paid for the land to reclaim just a small portion of it to better the lives of his people, education and being able to sustain themselves economically and so forth. Well, but the United Fruit Company didn't like that. And they had a sympathetic ear in Ellen Dulles, who was an investor, and John Foster Dulles, who was an investor and I think on the board, and Dwight Eisenhower's personal secretary, who had an investment in that company, and her husband was a PR rep for the United Fruit Company. So these guys conned the president, President Eisenhower, into believing that Arbenz was a communist and needed to be deposed. So there began that summer of 54, this big effort, and they ultimately did succeed in ousting the Arbenz, and it was really horrible what they did to that country. Among other things, they were kidnapping people off the street and putting them in vans, mutilating their bodies in some cases, and dumping them from helicopters in front of stadium-filled audiences at sporting events to terrorize the population. And they even had, at one point, Sarah reports in her book, loudspeakers with a tape running that made it sound like there were aircraft, enemy aircraft, getting ready to bomb and so forth. And so terrified everybody, including the military, that it was easy for them to just take over the country. And that precipitated the tragic circumstances of, Latin America that even prevailed into this day. So the reason I mention all this is this fits in with, ask yourself, why would Ron have even gone to the Panama School of Assassins? They didn't teach him how to bake bread there. He was taught skills there. Where was he going to use those skills? And when he came back from this excursion, he didn't enter journalism right away, although that was a key interest. He became an ambulance attendant, as Sarah discovered. Nobody else has got this information. It's only in Sarah's book. So that's kind of a thing like, did it, we can speculate. Was it so traumatic what he witnessed and what he participated in there? That all of a sudden, he had a change of heart and started working with, an ambulance crew. It's very odd. And
What the,
but her book has that.
yeah.
yeah, and Pataki's behavior after her death, like you said, there's a few other little things he did that were kind of I don't know, shady, for lack of a better term, sus, as the kids might say these days. What can you tell me, any other things?
Tell them about the other poem, or the
Oh,
zipper.
yeah. I mean, a prolific writer, putting a lot of this stuff just on a website, publicly available. So, yes, about poisoning. And then, of course, the one about a reporter
And coughs up in the stench.
can't tell lies when, zipper tight. And
Yeah, he actually
yeah,
describes.
it's very.
Do you have those handy in your book?
I'd
The
have to flip
poems are
through a little
actually
bit.
unbelievable. They are so autobiographical
And
about
then,
what happened to Dorothy.
later in life, went to the Jerry Falwell School for, kind of found God and, became very
But the
interested in that.
spiking of a drink was the clearest clue yet,
Oh, yeah.
because the administration of that drug, the drink that Dorothy liked, was such that it would very easily conceal anything that would be added to that beverage.
Yes, I have the spiking poem.
Okay.
Did you want me? Okay. It's called Vodka Roulette, seen as relief possibility. While I'm spilling my guts, she is driving me nuts. Please fetch us two drinks on the run. Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison, and don't even tell me which one. So,
And the zip
thought,
type one.
yes, I'm still seeing what page that one's on. But yeah, I mean, these seem
But
like kind of
he
subliminal.
also, right after Dorothy died, in his own column, keep in mind this is in the Columbus newspaper, which was owned by a different newspaper chain,
Yeah,
but he
Scripps
was
Howard.
not nationally syndicated.
No, and we didn't realize that at first, but as I was going through all the newspaper archives looking for Dorothy's work, I could not find Ron outside of Ohio. And again, coming back to my work as a newspaper reporter, where we're all on a shoestring budget, how was he being flown to Hollywood and New York City? He and Dorothy had met the summer before in Europe on the Sound of Music press junket. Where is the budget for this? It's just mind blowing to me.
If his newspaper wanted to cover Hollywood, they would just run the stuff from
On the
the
over the
city.
wire. Yeah.
Yeah, that came from their owners.
Who
Why
was
would he be
in
sent to, you know, he
Yeah.
had.
It's not even the main paper in Columbus. Columbus Dispatch is sort of like the, even back then, was the biggest one. So it's sort of the B paper, but yet they're flying around
Even
everywhere.
more of a question.
Well,
Yeah.
Ron also had quite, and Sarah goes into this as well. She has quite a profile of his early life and his, my gosh, he had charms, and she has pictures in her book of him with all these different stars. Mia Farrow was a
They
date,
dated,
Alexis Smith, a
yeah.
bunch of people, beauty queens. It's quite the charmer. But he trafficked in circles, like we were talking one time about the Lawfords, Pat Lawford and Kennedy, Pat Kennedy Lawford. And I said, why in the world was Pat Lawford going to the Calneva Lodge, you know, which was a stronghold for the mob? At the same time, her brothers, the JFK and the Attorney General, were prosecuting the mob. I mean, and he said, I know, I was all part of that. So he was very well connected. Another friend of his was Joseph Levine. And Joseph Levine, he said, held a big celebration because Ron had written some music for a musical score for one of his films. So this was just atypical for, I hate to say it, but a lowly reporter, entertainment reporter, who was not read outside of his own home territory.
The poem you're talking about, where was that published?
Well, I mean, he published a lot of his
Yeah,
own
he did a
stuff.
lot of
He's kind of a
self-published stuff, but a lot of that stuff
self-published.
was written right after. And I started to say in one
It's
of
on
his
his
own
website.
columns, he wrote a very bitter column also about the people of New York and so forth. And it could be interpreted as an attack on Dorothy right after
That
she
was right
died. That
after her
was
death.
immediately after her
Yeah.
death.
Huh.
So that was all very, very strange.
Interesting.
He had a volatile temper. We didn't really go
Yeah,
into that.
there
He'd
were
had
drug
some past.
deaths.
Alcohol was a problem with him,
Fighting.
fighting, you know, it's unbelievable all the scrapes he got into, not just in college, I'm talking about as an adult. And he lost a lot of, you know, relationships that way with women who just were fed up. Anna Maria Alberghetti, didn't you tell
Yes,
me,
opera
was
singer.
opera singer. You know, he dated some very classy women. He got fed
Sure.
up. But there was a reason. Why was he targeting Dorothy Kilgallen, an older woman, not a beauty queen exactly, and yet he said that they were the best of friends. They talked on the phone all the time. She would call him and say, "This is your New York secretary, Susie Cream Cheese." She also sent him letters referring to their little, what was the thing about
Their
Edith
little
Wharton
room at
at the Regency
the
Hotel? Yeah.
Regency Hotel.
So I mean, they had a very, you know,
But I think he was the perfect person to recruit. You know, Dorothy
yes.
had a relationship with Johnny Ray much younger. He's much younger. I think them both being journalists would have had a lot to connect over. I think he was the perfect recruit to keep Dorothy
He
under surveillance.
segued into being her sounding board as she was researching the Kennedy file. Maybe that's the most important thing we've said on this interview, that he was hearing regularly, daily from her. So he was in a position to know what progress she had made on her investigation, and it would have been voluminous.
And I feel like even maybe bragging a little bit about his involvement, saying, well, yeah, she'd read
Yeah.
this to me, get my view. Do I change it? Do you like it?
He said one time she called him and said, I'm having trouble with the lead. Let me read you what I've got. And what do you think of this? So he was helping her write what ended up being a book that she hoped to publish.
Interesting. Yeah, the parts about him being an entertainment reporter for like the B newspaper in Columbus and then going all over the place, even though he's not syndicated, and they could have just ran the syndicated
Right. And just to amplify that point, I know for a fact from some of my own writing, I've done other books and so forth, that the CIA was recruiting people in the media. This is well known. Even Philip Graham of the Washington Post and Catherine Graham continued that tradition. The vaunted, you know, Catherine the Great also was helping the CIA. Also, the guy that was, you know, the Luce, Henry Luce, Life magazine, all that. They had CIA connections. There were reporters whose income was supplemented by the CIA. And this came out later, you know, the Church Committee and so forth, all these investigations. And of course, there were intelligence reforms because of the abuses of James Angleton and so forth. So Senate panels have investigated a lot of this stuff. And the Spiegel thing was a big thing in the New York Times.
Claire Booth Luce, I believe her name was.
Oh, yes.
I recall reading in Gaten Fonzie's book, Gaten Fonzie, the HSCA investigator, that when he was down in the Florida Keys researching some things, Claire Booth Luce reached out to him and gave him an urgent lead he needed to pursue. And he spent all this time going after it. And it was just that she had fabricated it. He learned that she got a hold of him just to try to burn his time. So that was the related point.
Sarah will tell you that it's in her book that when Ron Pataki met Dorothy on this press junket overseas, when he walked up to her, he asked, "Are you Claire Booth Luce?" We found that strange because Claire Booth Luce was considerably older. Was he thinking he was flattering Dorothy by asking that question? You know, it's difficult, you know, in an interview like this to really dissect and cover all the details. But, oh, my God, this book, at least a third of it is JFK, JFK, mm-hmm. and the things that Dorothy was uncovering, plus things that validated her suspicions after she was gone. So it's very detailed, everything from the two caskets. And one revelation that blew my mind, and I've studied JFK for years, was the fact that on the day of the assassination, the press was told that there was a Secret Service agent also killed. Mm-hmm. It was reported on all the big media and the local media.
Yeah.
She also looked at the radio and TV broadcasts from the Dallas metro mm-hmm. area, and it was covered. They confirmed a Secret Service agent had been killed. It was in the newspapers that night.
Yeah.
And Merriman Smith actually won a Pulitzer Prize. He was a UPI reporter for his coverage of the Dallas thing. And he reported that a Secret Service agent was killed. Now, then it just evaporated. It was never mentioned again. And Sarah propounds a very logical argument that's not unlike some of the things that Doug Horne, I saw your interview with Doug Horne, this genius guy, really. And I think Doug is coming around to the way Sarah thinks about it, that the switch of the caskets occurred at the Parkland Hospital before it ever got to the plane. And the reason for this cover story about a second, for the death of a Secret Service agent would be in case anybody saw a shipping casket being put aboard a plane, they wouldn't think anything of it. They think, oh, that's a
poor, especially a basic one.
Yeah, a Secret Service agent. But how she explains all that and puts all these pieces together.
Yeah. And Dorothy didn't necessarily report on that, but it was important to kind of show what was happening in real time as things were evolving. One thing I didn't want you to forget mentioning is one time you just flat out asked, well, Pataki, well, who killed Dorothy? What do you think? And I think what he said supports kind of the thesis here.
He was always directing my attention away from the mob. So one author is just convinced that Marcello had this girl call, there may have been something to it, but Dorothy had aroused the antipathy of J. Edgar Hoover and other highly placed people. They had written unflattering things about her that are in FBI memos. And I think that they had a role in it. We all obviously all know, I think you agree with this, that the assassination could not have been carried out without some high level involvement by government people. I think LBJ would be involved in that loop. But so, Ron, every time we ever talked about this over the years, he always redirected my attention away from the mob and said, and I thought I had the quote here, but I don't think I printed it out. Well, and I'll paraphrase. Well, if she was killed, it was the government that did it.
And there's some what nasty people.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said, you know, we got some very nasty people in the government. So he
For what
was,
it's worth.
Yeah.
Did he say that he was there? Did he deny being there that night?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the stories he told about, the timeline, he told various stories to various people about where he was and how he found out. And we can confirm Sarah's big revelation also is he was definitely in New York City at least by the next day, possibly the very day she was killed, because he wrote something that was from New York.
That paper.
It's
that
funny,
paper
he never told me that.
Right. So that is pretty strong. And it's also like, if he did kill her, what are we talking about here? We're not talking about hitting her over the head with something.
No, spiking a drink.
A drink.
And she liked, wasn't it?
Vodka
and tonic.
Tonic water.
Tonic is a little bit bitter. You see this in old movies. I mean, you know, they're spiking a drink and they're putting in somebody's drink that has tonic water in it that's a little bit of a bitter taste.
Yeah.
And Sarah takes through the timeline. And also, you know, I had talked to Dr. Sarah Wecht on a couple of occasions because I wrote a book called The Real Marilyn Monroe, 768 pages. You see, anybody's interested? Actually, I
You
should
know, Marilyn and Dorothy's life intersect a little
I should
bit.
hold it up. There's a big overlap between Dorothy and
Yeah, I think if
yeah.
you recall from my book, we were originally going to do one book about both women, and then Dad over here has all the way went way overboard on research, so they split into two projects. But yes, I think people would even see that there's some parallels in Marilyn and Dorothy's death,
Yes,
right?
and
But
just
Marilyn gets labeled the suicide,
right. And
right?
what is kind of interesting is that it was really Dorothy's reporting about Marilyn that triggered on a Friday, triggered her Bobby Kennedy visit to her home, and that absolutely did happen. I take it all the way through. Sarah Wecht actually applauded my work. You know who he was, called the Godfather of forensic pathology. He praised my work and he reviewed my work before he died for meticulous and what was the other word? Impressive and meticulous research or whatever. And so he actually, you know, believed that. But Dorothy was suspicious of the Marilyn. And just like in the JFK case, she was unrelenting. She never gave up. And of course, Marilyn died in August of 62. And she just would not let up on that Marilyn case. And she was pointing out all these things and, you know, and just brazenly challenging the official story.
So another
Well,
opportunity of that, you know, high profile death of
yeah.
questioning, you know,
So she people
true.
knew she was not going to let, if she was on your tail, she was
Yeah.
not going to let up.
Larry, you alluded to that you've done, you know, a lot of other research here on the case. So one thing I want to ask you about specifically, you once interviewed David Bellin and then
And
the
live to tell about it. And
Please
that's
yeah.
not an inside
tell the
joke,
whole
actually.
story, though. The whole
Yeah,
story.
go ahead. Oh my God.
Just
David Bellin,
walk me through it.
Counsel for the Warren Commission. Go ahead.
Yes.
Based in Iowa, though, where we're from.
I decided because of my longtime interest that it would be good in the premier issue of Midwest Today, published in 1992, to do a story on the Midwest connections to the JFK case. And there were some, for example, Jack Ruby, Chicago connections, and so on. And so I got into this. I realized that David Bellin was right there in Des Moines, practicing attorney. I kept seeing him turn up on TV all the time, sick of seeing him, you know, because I knew he was stating things that were not factual. They were not a matter of opinion. They were just blatantly false. I didn't take that tact with him, however, when I asked for an interview, and he agreed to invite me to his office in a high rise in Des Moines. I took my tape recorder as usual. And I quoted him accurately in this 11-page think piece, the big extensive article that I ran. And I picked him apart. I let him state what he wanted to state, and then I picked him apart in it. I will just, before I forget to tell you, I do want to tell you that after the tape recorder was shut off and he was escorting me to the elevator, I half expected the elevator doors to open, there to be no elevator, and I'd be plunging to my death. That didn't happen. But he said to me something that's very significant. He said, "Someday I'm going to tell the world who I think put Oswald up to it." And he died without ever telling anybody that I know. And I always wondered, did he mean Ruth Payne? Or, I mean, who did he mean? I don't know. But even he thought somebody else had motivated Oswald to take that action. I don't believe that Oswald, you know, killed Kennedy, but I always found that interesting because wouldn't that imply there was a conspiracy?
Right.
Somebody motivated him to do that. But anyway, what happened was we were getting ready to go to press with this story. This was in the days before the internet. So there was no way anybody could hack an email or gain access to my computer unless they were physically present in my home. And of course, I didn't spend 24/7 in my home. I'd be going to the grocery store or whatever. But the magazine went to press with this story. It was all the materials were taken to the printer late at night on a Friday night. And the magazine went on press post midnight. It was a very long night. My wife, Julie, was with me. They had high security there anyway. I mean, you couldn't get from one point to another in this printing plant. And when I got home, very blurry eyed, and that Saturday morning, checked the mail, and here was a letter postmarked the day before from David Billman, in which he berated me, took issue with some of my assertions in my story, and quoted me from my article. And the first question that naturally occurred to me was, how the hell did he get this article? How did he know what I wrote? I didn't share that with anybody. Nobody knew that article. The only thing I could deduce is that somehow somebody gained access to my home and made a copy of it or printed out. I probably might have left it on the computer. There was no way for him to get that article.
Wow.
Now, I'm not sure if I want to tell the rest of the story.
Please do. Really.
But listen,
really.
I may need some pro bono legal advice from you as a lawyer as to whether I should.
Well, you know the convenient death thing about all
yeah,
the different
I would
witnesses.
Say that I didn't have a lot of confidence in my long-term survival after I interviewed this guy.
Yeah.
I guess I can tell the story, and I'm not really accusing him. I'm just telling the circumstances. Okay, so I'm not accusing David Bellin of anything, but I just found the circumstances odd.
Yeah.
Sometime, not long after the article appeared in the magazine, in which he was embarrassed, basically, in public print, there was an item in the Des Moines paper about a Larry Jordan who was struck and killed by a hit-and-run driver near my home. My mother happened to be visiting, and she noticed this article and called it to my attention. She had worked at the post office, and it said this: Larry Jordan was a member of a postal carrier, and the police were appealing to the public for any witnesses that could have seen this happen. Okay, I found that mildly interesting. And a few months later, my wife and I attended a political fundraiser at a country club, and among the attendees was David Bellin, whom she had met through her brother, who was a highly placed lobbyist in Iowa. So she went up, my wife went up to David Bellin, his back was to me. She introduced herself, said hello to him. And she said, by the way, Mr. Bellin, I think you know my husband, Larry. And he turned around and looked at me, and I've never seen anybody look so shocked. His eyes bugged out, his mouth dropped open. He turned pale as a ghost. It's like he'd seen a ghost. And he limply shook my hand, turned around and walked off. And I had the distinct impression that the wrong man was killed. And I felt a little bit more sorry. Maybe the reason why is because at that time, my sister-in-law was the attorney general of the
Bonnie
state
Campbell.
Of Iowa.
Yeah, and Ed Campbell.
Maybe that protected me.
Yeah.
Family associations.
Yeah.
Now, that's just my paranoid delusions, I grant you. But I did find it a little bit odd because this guy was very belligerent about his belief or his desire to perpetuate the myth of the lone assassin. I also got a call one time, we won't go into it today, from Arlen Specter out of the blue, called me. I found that a little bit odd. Why is Arlen Specter calling me? I was actually on another line. I said, Senator, may I ask you to please call me back in 15 minutes? And he did, and we had a conversation. And then I met him one time. He came up to me in a public place when I was with a singer friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a bunch of little weird things that were going on there. But the David Bellin thing, how he got a hold of it, that I stand by, absolutely stand by. He wrote a letter that he could not have written unless he perused my article, which was not yet publicly available in print.
That reminds me of John Newman. You guys know John Newman, the author, military intelligence guy. He shared with me the story of how his cell phone was taken from him during a conference. And then some guy, came up and whispered to him, like, they just want to know what you know, they're going to bring it back to you. And then he later found that it gone up into the same hotel where the conference was, like to the 10th floor, and then came back down, and they gave it to him. So anyway, yeah, that's kind of scary. I luckily have not had
something strange, but the reaction, the physical reaction of that man.
Yeah.
All the rest of it may not mean much, but the physical reaction of that man, I mean, his eyes just bugged out. I will never forget his face. When he looked at me, his jaw drops open, and he was literally, and Julie noticed it too, my wife. Wow. Was that? I think he felt like maybe the wrong person was hit.
Yeah. Well, let's just to wrap up, back to Dorothy Kilgallen. So it sounds like you guys think that probably Ron Pataki is the most likely. Nothing's certain, of course, but it sounds like that's probably the most likely scenario. And then there's this CIA link with Pataki going back to Guatemala, PB6S, which is the same covert operation led by E. Howard Hunt and David Atlee Phillips. It's all the same people who are down out of JM Wave.
I compliment you for knowing. I compliment you for knowing the name. I didn't mention it, but the name of that Guatemala action.
Well, thank you, sir. Well, and thank you for all of your work on the case. I'm sorry, I'm a rookie ultimately. I'm putting a lot of time into it now. I put in about 25 hours a week on it these days, but I got a lot of time to catch up on from some of the folks that have been doing this their whole lives for sure. So I guess Sarah, your both of your books are available on Amazon, I take it. Is there a preferred place for people to buy them?
On Amazon, paperback ebook is also on Audible,
Okay.
and then PageTurnerBooks.biz. You can see kind of our whole catalog of Dad's also written on Jim Reeves, the country singer. That's where it all began for your books, the Maryland.
You
My
can
book
get
on
an autographed
Dorothy.
copy. People that want an autographed copy. It's amazing how many people. She's really quite the celebrity. They want the autographed with their name, and sometimes they dictate the dedication. My very best friend Joe.
Yes, I just want to always make sure whatever I'm committing myself to is not
Right.
illegal. But yes, page
Oh,
turn
I
not
will
me.
show you one more thing. I figured that there were a lot of people that don't want to wield a 768-page book on Maryland, although it's very comprehensive, very, very. So a lot of things about her death that I dug deep in a way that I promise you no other author has done. Then I actually concentrated on just the final days of her life, the final year of her life. And it has a lot of the same things about her death. But I was able to peruse, for example, Bobby Kennedy's desk diaries. And I looked at a lot of press coverage that nobody else has paid attention to because millions of newspaper pages have been digitized in recent years. And so you can go back and search. I searched Marilyn's entire life. By the way, Sarah used that same methodology in digging up a lot of things that had previously never been available. But then now they're at our fingertips. So a lot of that was all combined on both of these books.
Great. Well, hey, it's a pleasure to have you guys on today. Certainly, I learned a lot, and I guess the takeaway is
Our takeaway is don't sell Dorothy short.
don't
She was
sell
a
it.
true hero in
Sure.
the journalism profession, and her contribution to history was significant. And
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, if you had to comp I mean, is there anybody today who's even close to a Dorothy Kilgallen type figure? I mean, who's it, first of
yeah.
all, it would be impossible today because everything's so fragmented, and the TV was such a huge deal. Her newspaper syndication was such a huge deal, and she was authentically pursuing objective truth as opposed to some corporate, goal.
Right, exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, you always think of like a Barbara Walters type, but Dorothy was also kind of a fashion icon. She was at fashion shows, style, the radio show with her husband, Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. They had millions of followers on that. What's My Line? The Hearst Syndicate, not just column, but byline news articles. A column can be a little more first person conversational. A news article is, the hard news. She was writing that constantly.
When she went to New Orleans, Dallas, Miami, that's the nexus of that whole anti-Castro Cuban, effort. So that's why she picked those cities. And she did that. Remember, she was on that Larry King radio show just days before she died down in Miami.
You guys definitely check out Larry and Sarah's books,
Thank you.
and if you want more on Dorothy Kilgallen, it sounds like there's a ton there, and I personally am looking forward into revisiting it and diving into it more. I got your book around the time when it came out, and but I want to go back and reread the whole thing again. So, very very cool, Larry. I'll have to check out yours as
Thank
well. Your
you.
work
Thank you. Appreciate that.
on Marilyn Monroe. That's great. Solving JFK, listeners, viewers. We will be back next week with a recap and rebuttals episode on the Mafia with Lou Ferrante, and then we'll be back the following week with a recap and rebuttals episode on Jack Ruby, which obviously this whole conversation tied into. So yeah, thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate having you
Thank
on.
you.
Talk soon.